Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jay Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week, as always, is Cleveland area attorney and sometime Republican strategist Jay Carson. Our top story this week is yesterday's Republican presidential primary in South Carolina, where, as expected, Donald Trump scored an easy win, finishing with 32.5% of the vote, 10 points better than surprise number two finisher Marco Rubio, who ended up just edging out Ted Cruz. I think the other big surprise was Jeb Bush, who put a lot of effort into the state. And after finishing at only 7.8%, he barely beat out John Kasich, who really wasn't even trying in the state, Bush put himself out of his own misery by quitting the race. So what did you think about South Carolina's results, Jay?
Well, I believe if we go back to my predictions last week, I was just about right on.
Well, let's see here.
I think I may have given Cruz an edge, but I said Rubio a very close third.
Okay, let's go back into the Wayback Machine.
Yeah.
Jay, you said Trump over Cruz right. by 5% with Rubio and Bush fighting for third. I had Trump by 15% over Cruz with Rubio and Bush fighting for third. So we both picked Trump. I sort of thought Trump would win bigger, but he won by what? About 10%.
About 10,
yeah,
think.
So we kind of split the difference, I suppose we could say.
Right.
But I don't think either of us expected Bush to do quite so poorly.
No, I sort of did. I mean, if you remember, I think we talked about how George W. was popular in South Carolina, but still he only won that primary kind of by the skin of his teeth back in 2000. So I mean, I guess I'm surprised that he's suspending the campaign because we never quit.
We just suspend.
I'm from my Republican side. I mean, I'm grateful that he's suspending it because
absolutely.
I think that's going to be a major shift now as we move into Super Tuesday. I feel pretty comfortable. I'm a little surprised that Trump did as well among evangelicals as he did. I would have expected that to have been lower. But again, we're talking about matters of degrees. I think we both said, and most everyone said, Trump was going to win.
Yeah.
Although I'm rightfully proud of our predictions that sort of took the underside where so many of the polls were saying, you know, Trump by 20 and so forth.
Right.
And I was reading even, going into, polls Friday saying, well, these are probably understating the Trump effect. And, he could just – it just could be a huge Trump landslide. And he won, but again, not by the tremendous margins. And we're starting to get to that point where you look at everyone else and those numbers as people drop out, are creeping up and Trump's are creeping down.
So. Right. And now Trump will win all of the delegates here. And that brings his delegate total. What right now his delegate total is 61 to Cruz's 11 and Rubio's 10. But again, there's a long way to go. You need 1,237 to win the nomination. And of course, one of the questions I think is, well, where do Bush's supporters go? And more importantly, maybe, where does his impressive fundraising machine, who do they get behind?
Right.
So what do you think? Where do Bush's supporters go? Now, Donald Trump already weighed in on this. He said they don't understand that as people drop out, I'm going to get a lot of those votes also.
I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I would agree.
Especially coming from I might even see Cruz people, if were Cruz to drop out, maybe some Cruz voters defecting to Trump. But I don't see Bush, who is the most mainstream of mainstream voters, making that leap.
Yeah, you know,
if anything, it's almost as if you were voting for Jeb Bush, that's almost like a Trump protest vote.
Right. Right. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There can be no one more against Trump than Jeb Bush. The most, the least
Trumpy.
Yeah. So But my gut tells me they probably go to Rubio. Now I don't know enough about the inside Florida stuff and there were some shots back and forth between Jeb and Rubio before. I don't know how serious that is, if his people really dislike Rubio. I don't think so. I think the natural place for them to go would be Rubio, and maybe some to Kasich.
Yeah, I would agree. And, we've pointed this out before. Okay, so Trump gets 32.5% of the vote here. He got 35% of the vote in New Hampshire. And I think that's pretty much where he tops off. We've been saying it for a long time. It's maybe a third of the Republican primary electorate. And that's impressive when there are five candidates in the race. But those votes are not going to go to him, and things are going to start to consolidate. Rubio pointed out, he said, well, now it's essentially a three-person race. I don't know if it's quite yet a three-person race. John Kasich certainly would argue against that. And Ben
Carson. Three and a half-person race. Perhaps.
And Ben
no
Carson.
John Kasich, of whom I'm a huge fan, but
And who knows what Ben Carson is doing exactly at this point. I don't know that Ben Carson knows exactly what he's doing at this point, but maybe he just likes to be on the stage for the debates. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think this is all sort of playing out just as we expected, though you sure wouldn't know it by listening to the media and the pundits totally freaking out. I saw this totally goofy clickbait headline in Politico: "Is Trump now inevitable?" And, of course, no, he's not. And one thing people should keep in mind is that the Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina GOP primary electorates, they look a lot different from the population that's going to be voting in the general election. A lot different.
Right. And, something else to consider: that the states that are coming up, the big delegate prize state is Florida. I think most people would assume that will go to Rubio.
Right. Florida and Texas,
and
of course, will go to.
All.
Yeah. That's a little ways down the road. But yeah, the next big one, of course, is Texas. And not obviously, but I think it's fairly safe to say that. Yeah, 155 delegates. But yeah, Florida, I think, is strong for Rubio. And I guess Kasich's strategy is just to kind of hang in there until he can get to some of the Midwestern states where he can make some sort of a mark.
Right. I think Kasich hangs in to Ohio. And at that point, he's in a decent position to, for people to, I think, if they haven't already been taking him seriously as a vice presidential pick, I think he really, if he hangs in that long, I think that's great. And I the message that Kasich is getting out there, again, is more of an anti-Trump message. So I think Kasich hangs in. I don't know what Ben Carson does. Again,
he's so hard to predict.
It's all a little inexplicable.
I mean, he has no real path to anything. So I don't. I mean, Kasich is really sort of a Hail Mary sort of thing at this point. I think it sure looks like Rubio said, like a three-person race. But as you mentioned, the next big contest is, well, a lot of contests. Super Tuesday, we get a little bit of a break because it's not until March 1st. It's also been called the SEC primary because a majority of those 11 states that are going to be voting will be in the South. And there are going to be 595 delegates up for grabs. So that's a lot, though all of those are proportionally allotted. So no one's going to come away with this huge, huge insurmountable lead out of this. And we haven't gotten to the part of the calendar where the Republican Party allows for winner-take-all primaries. That's not until the 15th. I think we're going to see some separation after Super Tuesday. And I expect Trump to do, reasonably well. And there are going to be more crazy headlines and so forth. But if I would advise people of anything, I'd say remain calm. It's going to be fine, Donald Trump.
All is well.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the prediction markets, which I stopped doing because they're completely useless, I think they probably bounce all over the place. I think Donald Trump, a lot of people seem to think he's the inevitable candidate. And God knows he thinks he's the inevitable candidate, at least if you listen to his Twitter feed, which I have to admit, guilty secret, I don't know. I just started following just for the sheer amazement value of it. Yeah, really. So, but yeah, it's going to be, I think in the end, it's going to be Rubio. I expect Kasich to be the next one to drop out, though I think that's going to be a while. That won't be till after Super Tuesday at the earliest.
Yep.
Okay.
I agree. Yeah.
All right. Well. So let's turn to the Democratic side, because the Democrats had a thing. Caucus goers in Nevada gave Hillary Clinton a narrowish 5-point victory over Bernie Sanders.
And I believe that I completely nailed it on that one.
Yes, in fact, you did. You said Clinton by 5% over Sanders. I was probably going with hope over reality. I don't know. I predicted just the opposite, Sanders by 5 over Clinton, and you were absolutely right, Jay. I think there's no question that you have been our better predictor to this point, so kudos to you. Now, in terms of delegates, Clinton comes away with 19-15 for Bernie, but because of Clinton's huge lead in the unbound Democratic so-called superdelegates, she has a really commanding overall advantage of 502 to 70. But still, there's a long way to go. The Democrats need, you need 2,383 delegates to clinch their nomination. So plenty of time to go, though. Still, I don't think that there's much of a shot of Bernie Sanders overtaking Hillary Clinton because things start to get really tough for Bernie going forward.
And I would agree with the asterisks that I've been putting out there for a while, is that nothing really blows up with the Justice Department.
Right. Sure.
And that investigation that could fundamentally change things. And if so, I think some of it benefits Bernie. I think the other thing is maybe then you start have rumblings of a third party, a Bloomberg or someone like that. Of course, he said he would be an independent.
Right.
But, I think that's absent that, I agree that structurally Clinton still is set to win, and organizationally she's got the troops on the ground and the organization to do it.
So as a Republican, what would your preference be? Would it be A, for Clinton to win the nomination, but for that Justice Department stuff to hit in a big way after that point? Or would it be for that Justice Department stuff to hit, because I'm assuming you want that to happen no matter what, and for Sanders to win the nomination? What are you thinking?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Gosh, that's sort of a here are two like wonderful
yeah, great scenarios for you. Yeah, I mean, both of them are great.
Okay,
sure.
Then this may sound weird, and this is maybe the little more political geek side of me, political theory side of me, is I think I'd rather see her get knocked out of the primary, and then Sanders be the nominee. Just because if we want to talk about having an ideological argument, I think Bernie Sanders he's styled himself as sort of the champion of democratic socialism.
Absolutely.
And, you know, two visions of government. Whereas Clinton, again, is more just a, we'll call it, I don't know if you want to call it a cult of personality.
She's a Clinton Democrat, sort of, you know. So.
Yeah, I mean, she's, you know, trying to cultivate that. I'd rather see the clear cut, here are two visions for our country and slug it out on that, as opposed to win an election based solely on the personal failings of the candidate.
Right.
Well, does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That's very sporting of you, I would say.
Yeah.
So, now, of course, the next contest for the Democrats happens this coming Saturday on February 27th, where they go to South Carolina. And now current polling suggests that Hillary Clinton's going to score a huge win. She's ahead in the polls by somewhere around 25 points on average. So I think even if things tighten up some, which they may, it's hard to imagine that, for me at least, that Sanders is going to make it much of a contest. What do you think, Jay?
I think the polls are on this time. I am going with the absolute conventional wisdom. And I say Hillary by at least 20.
Okay, you know what?
And my reasons are a couple. One we touched on the Wednesday mini podcast is there a support among African Americans. The Democratic electorate in South Carolina is, I think, just about one half African American.
Yeah.
Bernie Sanders does not do well among those that demographic.
Nope.
Second, this is still the South, and I don't think socialism sells well.
No, not
South.
Really. Not outside the coastal areas. Yeah, well, the northern coastal areas.
Not as well as it sells in Vermont college towns.
No, not at all.
And again, I think it is just sort of there's a cultural disconnect, and Clinton's been there before, and he hasn't. So I think the polls and the conventional wisdom is pretty much on this one, and it's going to be Hillary by a lot.
Yeah, and you know, I hate to do this, but I will anyway, because I'm going to go with Clinton by 22, because I'm not stealing that from you. Honest, you'll have to take my word for it, but that's kind of my sense. I think we'll tighten a little bit, but not that much. And you know, to me, really, this race reminds me, on both sides, kind of reminds me of the NBA season this year. I mean, Hillary Clinton is sort of the Golden State Warriors of the group. Yes. I mean, she's pretty clearly destined to end up in the finals. I think Marco Rubio is kind of the Cleveland Cavaliers of the group. You know,
I appreciate that.
You know, yeah. You know, I think he's probably going to get there, but there could be, you know, something could happen. Sure, I don't know who Ted Cruz would be. Toronto Raptors, I guess, would probably be the best guess or something like that. But yeah, you know, I think all this hyperventilating about the early contest is like getting worked up over the first 2 weeks of the NBA season. I mean, but of course you got to do that to get those clicks and to sell that ad time.
Yep.
And now after South Carolina, where Clinton will win huge, it'll be Super Tuesday for the Democrats as well. And that same day on March 1st. And then that's going to be, I think things are going to get really interesting at that point.
Yes.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well, let's move on to non-presidential race politics, but this certainly is related to it. The death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia the day before we recorded last week's Politics Guys continues to roil a really crazy presidential campaign. I mean, first was the issue of whether President Obama should even choose a replacement, which, ridiculous, of course he should, followed by the issue of whether Senate Republicans had a duty to hold hearings for an Obama nominee. And I'd say, hey, they legally don't, but I argue that they should, even if they reject that nominee, which I think they almost certainly will.
Well, I appreciate the concession that they legally don't.
Of course they don't. Yeah. You know. And then there was this ridiculous talk about whether we're in a constitutional crisis. You know, Jay, the Civil War was a constitutional crisis. This is not a constitutional crisis. This is a media frenzy, you know. And then there was the big thing about President Obama not going to Justice Scalia's funeral, which was held yesterday. And you know, I am a fan of a lot of what President Obama has done. I voted for him a couple times, but I think he was absolutely wrong to not go. Maybe there was some stuff going on in the background between President Obama and Scalia's family that we don't know about. But just going on what I've seen, what I've heard, I think it was totally the wrong move to send Joe Biden and not go himself.
Oh, absolutely. Joe Biden is someone you send when the, you know, whatever, the deputy economic minister of
Kazakhstan, Namibia, or something. Or, yeah, whatever. Something, yeah. He's the second string. Exactly. Yeah. You know,
And it's, you know, the idea of sending someone to travel the other side of the world. And this is you know, in Washington.
He could have walked there.
Yeah. And this is something that we might touch on later. And I know we have some friends in England who listen to us, but you know, I think it's a curious thing. This is a political science geek thing too. Our president is the head of government, and he is also the head of state.
That's right.
And I think that's, you know, typically the head of state part of the position, the ceremonial stuff, is the part of the job that is really hard to screw up.
Yeah, you show up, you know, and I mean, you act respectful, and yeah,
it is. It is don't literally fall asleep. 90% of it is showing up.
Yeah.
You know, so I am disappointed that he wasn't there. Scalia, wherever he is, I imagine is probably not disappointed, or is probably just chuckling over the whole thing.
Yeah, I would expect.
The president ought to go to the funeral of a Supreme Court justice, especially one who has passed away. I was going to look up funerals of prior Supreme Court justices. I didn't get a chance. But I would be very much surprised if you didn't have sitting presidents, former presidents attending those funerals.
For this one,
maybe one of our listeners knows and can let us know, or we can do a checkup. But
right.
Yeah, I really think these are the moments where there's the opportunity for us to come together as Americans and sort of celebrate our Americanness. Celebrate the idea that we can have differing opinions and still respect one another. And I think he missed a shot at doing that.
Yeah, and we're not talking about either. It's not we're talking about any Supreme Court justice. Not that, you know, they're not a pretty unique breed. It's not like Justice Alito keeled over or something. And, you know, he's okay, he's a conservative and so forth, but he's not revered by a huge chunk of the American public,
right.
You know.
Right.
And so this to me, it just puzzles me really more than anything else, because it seems like why would you give Republicans even more ammunition? I like I said, that's what makes me think there's something going on that hasn't been reported, because otherwise this is just a brain dead, stupid decision, I think, no matter how you look at it. So, and regardless of what people may think about President Obama, he's not a stupid man. So I think there's got to be something else going on that I don't know about. You're not going to give him the benefit of the doubt here. I understand. I would disagree, but anyway.
I think it was dumb. And let's talk briefly about the replacement discussion.
Yeah.
Because I think what's going to happen, and there's this idea of the Senate is being obstructionist; they won't take anyone, and you've seen all this bouncing back on social media. At least I have. Of reminding us of how long every Supreme Court justice has taken to replace, and who died in office, and what part of the term it was. And I think I guess what I want to say is sort of the claims that Republicans are somehow hypocritical, or Democrats are hypocritical, either way, is just sort of nonsense. And I wish we could get over that. Republicans are being charged with hypocrisy because Reagan appointed Justice Kennedy in the last year of his term. Republicans are also rightfully pointing out that, people like Chuck Schumer had said, we will reject any Bush nominee, and Obama filibustered Alito and all that sort of thing. I just want to say, sort of get over it, America. It's a little bit like saying your beloved Pittsburgh Steelers are, hypocritical because, look, a couple plays ago, you were trying to move the ball down the field, and now you're trying to tackle the guy with the ball. So.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I think both sides are being hypocritical, but that's politics. That's what you say, I don't have a problem with it. Yeah.
All procedural arguments are.
It's the mock outrage. It's that. Oh my God! I can't believe they're doing that. Well, please. How naive are you? It's not being naive. It's just And I totally agree. It's just how politics is done.
It's part of the game. It's sort of a kabuki theater type. Thing that you go through, and everybody knows you go through it. And
absolutely. Yeah. So, in the absence of any actual developments, and there won't be any until President Obama names somebody, there have been all sorts of discussion about the makeup of the court and so forth. And out of all this stuff that I've read and heard, I think there are two things that really interested me. Number one, the finding that no other democracy gives their judges lifetime appointment. And number two, that, and this is kind of an odd one, that maybe an 8-member court isn't such a bad thing, and that in some ways you could argue that's actually better than having 9 justices, which is
the idea being that there will be more pressure to compromise if there's 8 than 9.
Yeah, more pressure to compromise. Then you don't have one justice in the middle who's kind of that swing person. You have 2 swing people, so you maybe have more moderate decisions to try to catch those people. And not only that, but of course, as our listeners know, I think we mentioned this last week, when there was a tie decision, that means the lower court ruling is undisturbed. And so that allows for more, I guess you could call it judicial federalism in a sense. Not really, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, no, and here's where I'll disagree with you. And this is coming, I'm putting on my lawyer hat here.
All right.
Part of the problem I would see with having an 8-member court would be clarity in the law.
Right.
It already can get sort of muddled where you've got, justices, concurring in part, dissenting in part, and you're trying to come up with what exactly is the holding of the court. If you've got a situation where it's 4-on-4 and you're trying to make sense of, some guy's sort of concurring in this part and dissenting in this part, that makes it tricky. I think it leads to sort of less finality, more ambiguity. And that then ties to the second part. Again, when we say judicial federalism, from a state perspective, yeah, I'm a big fan of federalism. But one of the big purposes of the Supreme Court is to settle conflicts between the various appellate districts.
Right, right.
So that you have a uniform federal law. I think that's, I mean, when we talk about federalism, the idea is, okay, different states can have different state laws. But, you know, that's not what we want. And my concern would be, you could have various situations where you have a case that comes up from one court of appeals and, you know, you can't quite get the majority to overturn it there. And you have virtually the same case that can come up from another circuit court. You can't overturn it there. And you do start getting this fractured jurisprudence, which, again, this is, you know, maybe this is a little bit academic, but no, it is sort of a real deal in terms of, you know, the real world impact when companies make decisions and people write contracts about what law will govern and where the suit will be brought and all that sort of thing. It can throw a lot of things out of whack.
Yeah.
Again, this sounds weird arguing this.
No, no. In the end, I actually agree with you.
That's my reason for yeah. You know.
No, I think in the end, I agree with you. I also think that for as long as the court has eight members, if big things come up, depending on how long it takes for a ninth justice to be confirmed, I think actually this puts a lot of pressure, I would argue perhaps, on Justice Roberts, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, because, you know, as you know, Jay, a lot of conservatives have felt in the past betrayed by John Roberts because of some of his decisions. But my reading is that in some of the cases, like the Obamacare ruling, that he sort of appreciated the fact that he's trying to get the court to sort of take a position for its legitimacy. And, you know, he's concerned about more than just partisan politics. He said that a number of times. And so I think he's a different – certainly he's a conservative. But I think he tries to sort of see the court in a broader sense than perhaps his fellow conservatives on the court have. And maybe that's part of the role of being Chief Justice. And I think that's given that he's gotten some heat from you know, real red meat sort of conservatives. But I think in that sense, while I don't agree with his ideology on a lot, I agree with that view of the court, if that, in fact, is how he sees it.
Wow. That was surprisingly cogent. That's
every once in a while, you know.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Roberts, and people have said this after the Obamacare decision, he's playing the long game.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. You know, it's almost like I talked a couple minutes ago about, you know, football. If we want to analogize the different, you know, parties in the legislative branch and the executive branch as football teams competing one way or the other.
Which we do.
Yeah. To some extent, the role of the court is kind of like NFL commissioner. And it goes not just to which team is winning, but they have a responsibility to the integrity of the game.
Right.
Overall. And I think that's...
I'd say the court's doing a lot better job than Roger Goodell, thank God. But
right.
Yeah, that's a low standard.
So, yeah, I didn't mean to imply that, but...
No, we're not saying
That's an important role.
Absolutely.
That integrity of the game type thing.
So,
and part of that is, you know, again, to extend the metaphor even further than it should. Back in the Obamacare decision, Roberts essentially said, you know, hey, let them play.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, moving on to that other question that's come up. That idea that I didn't realize this, that no other democracy gives their judges lifetime appointment. And of course, in the wake of this, a lot of folks have said, well, why don't we move to, say, 18, 20-year terms or a fixed retirement age? And one of the advantages of that, obviously, would be that there'd be a lot more regularity. These things wouldn't be big crises because we could see them kind of happening. We would know when there would be a new nomination fight and so forth. And so
crisis, but
yeah, Christ, right. It's not a crisis, exactly, but a made-up media crisis. But, you know, actually, I think there's a lot to be said for this, not that I think it's ever going to happen, but I think if I were designing a judicial system from scratch, I don't know if I'd put in term limits, but I probably would put in a retirement age, one or the other, I think. What do you think, Jay?
You know, it's kind of funny. If you think back when our founding fathers wrote the Constitution, it probably seemed unlikely. I mean, a life term probably seemed shorter than what a life term is now.
Absolutely.
You know, and not that people didn't live long back then.
No.
Because I think Benjamin Franklin lived really into his 90s, I believe.
Yeah.
But the idea that you would have people serving well into their 70s, 80s, might have surprised folks. And how old was Thurgood Marshall when he stepped down?
He was up there.
I believe he was into his 90s, right?
And you know, and there are these concerns that people have, saying that, you know, justices, of course, they're going to lose some of their mental acuity, and there have
been
stories.
Clerks do most of the work anyway.
Yeah, and you know, that's the concern. Obviously, is no one's confirming the clerks, right? So yeah. I mean, that's a reasonable concern. And there was talk about Justice Marshall, I know, and maybe a few other justices, and you can understand why they wouldn't necessarily want to give up that job. It's a really nice job, you know. It's a great job. So
yeah, no, I would say I am not. Again, I agree with you. It's not gonna ever happen. I also don't like the, you know, I think it just adds a whole other element to the politicalization of the court when you've got, say, okay, this guy's term is coming up this time, and you know, there's this appointment. It removes a little bit of the independence of the court.
I guess it could,
which I think
possibly
is important.
Yeah, I like the idea of the regularity of knowing when. Yeah. You know, I would actually think maybe with the retirement ages or terms, it gives us a sense of when there's going to be a fight, and things could be, especially if there were term lengths, you could set things up so that there probably wasn't going to be a new justice having to be appointed in an election year or something like that to try to take some of the politics out of it. Though, you know, one thing I want to point out, but
who would do that? Why would you do that? You'd want to inject more politics into it.
Yeah. And you know, and a lot of folks point out that, speaking of injecting politics into it, that the Republicans seem a lot more worked up over this. And I think it's important to keep in mind. Yeah. Well, for a number of reasons, but it's important to keep in mind the history. And a lot of people don't know the history. And I read a great article in Mother Jones magazine. I know right away you think, I know you're ready. But no, it was an article in Mother Jones pointing out that you have to consider the rough history that the Republicans have had, starting from Robert Bork. Republicans have felt that they have been poorly served by a lot of Supreme Court nominations, whereas Democrats in recent history don't feel that way. Many Republicans have felt betrayed. So Republicans have more reason to be skeptical and more reason to be angry. And I think they're absolutely right about that. I think Republicans should be more worked up. And not only because, of course, it's a conservative that has left the court now because of his death. And so I don't think that it's unusual. I don't think it's unfair for Republicans to be worked up about this. They should be, much more so than, say, Democrats would be if Justice Ginsburg or someone like that left the bench.
And I'll say something that will probably be uncharitable to Democrats.
Well, that's unusual.
Along the lines of the discussion we had about identity politics, and you know, why don't the Republicans get more credit for diversity? To some extent, you know, the Democrats almost don't really care. There's not a particular judicial philosophy. It's sort of, so long as we sort of get what we want. Maybe that's being uncharitable.
Yeah, but I think it is. Yeah, absolutely.
But from the real judicial conservative wing, I mean, it goes to integrity of the game, again, rather than here's the policy outcome I'd like.
Sure.
And I think you can make a lot of, a pretty big case that so many of the decisions are, you know, policy outcome. I mean, the gay marriage one is one we talked about. I think we both agreed, look, that's was there a really good constitutional rationale for that decision? Not so much, but it was a policy outcome that they wanted to reach, so they did. That is something that most conservatives are rightfully concerned about. That it goes to, is that what the court's job is? And Scalia was the chief voice stating what the court's proper role ought to be, particularly as conservatives see it, not as a policy board, but as a commissioner of the league.
Yeah, absolutely. I kind of, to move on, I know we're running a little bit long, but there is one more story I wanted to talk about, because believe it or not, there was more going on in the past week than just the presidential race and the aftermath of Justice Scalia's death. Hard to believe. It was an action-packed week. As I'm sure you know, Jay, right on Tuesday, a federal magistrate judge ordered Apple to help the FBI unlock the iPhone used by one of the attackers in the San Bernardino terrorist shooting, which left 14 people dead.
Yep.
And Apple has resisted this and plans to appeal the ruling. So What's Apple's problem here, Jay?
Well, you know, this is a tough one for me, and I think this is why we need good courts, good judges. From a Fourth Amendment standpoint, there is absolutely no reason why the government can't do everything it wants to get into that phone. It's a little bit different. It's a little where you're calling upon a private entity to sort of force them to give up, what are essentially trade secrets, their code, in order to do this.
So let me ask you this, Jay, before you get a little more into it, just to help
me understand
here. So how is this any different than, say, if there's a search warrant for a safe deposit box and the Department of Justice has the bank provide the key to open the box? How is this any different from that? And that's, of course, no one raises any, concerns about that. So how is this different?
I think it's different in that you're asking the and this wades into some technical stuff that I may be over my head. But in terms of giving away sort of the encryption keys as to how to do this, my understanding is that they would actually be calling on Apple to sort of break their own code and let the government know that. And Apple doesn't want the government to be able to just break into its encryption,
right?
Like that.
Yeah.
My sense is there's probably some way to work this out. There's probably some technical workaround that you can do, because no, you're completely right. There's every reason that the government ought to be able to get this information.
And just to be clear,
I think their statement was a little bit, overstated, kind of self-serving, kind of
sure
preening almost.
Which you'd expect from Apple, maybe, I don't know, but
yeah, they could have done it better, I think, saying, listen, we want to help the government. We're not comfortable with the process that's being set forth here. Let's see what we can do. And my sense is, if their lawyers are smart and the government's lawyers are smart, and I think they all are, they're probably coming up with some sort of workaround.
I think
because I'll tell you, I do this all the time in my practice. When somebody wants information, and they're entitled to it, but you can't give to it the way it is, and it's there are ways to do workarounds, protective orders, eyes only, third party, that kind of stuff. So,
my view, it's kind of along the lines of what you're saying, is that Apple has to fight this fight, even if they don't necessarily want to, even if they know how it's going to turn out, because they need to show their customers they'll go as far as they possibly can to protect their privacy. And that's exactly what they're doing. So I don't have any problem with what they're doing. I'm not outraged with what they're doing. I think they know what the end game of this is. They're going to work out something where the FBI is going to be able to get into this phone, and that's fine. But customers need to believe that the company that they're entrusting their privacy to is going to do everything.
The terrorists who buy these phones.
Where else are terrorists going to go? Are they going to buy Android phones? My gosh. But it's a serious concern, because of course, as encryption gets better and better, it's becoming increasingly easy to design encryption that, the FBI, NSA can't get into. In this case, you have to, put in a password in your phone, and if you guess it wrong 10 times, it erases everything. So Apple's actually being asked not to provide a key they already have, but to rewrite their firmware for the phone so that they take away that 10 guess, erase it, and so the FBI can do what's called like a brute force attack and just kind of throw in a gazillion passwords. And it would take about half an hour to open the phone in that case.
Right.
And
without the self-destruct.
Exactly. So, but I think that's how it's going to turn out.
And I guess, that's sort of what it comes down to again, the difference between, and you expressed it better than I did there, the bank just opening the safe deposit box. This is sort of more like the bank would have to make a new key, in order to do it. And you're really putting a burden on private companies that ought not to be there. And quite honestly, this is something. There's also the precedent just of if it's a matter of you have to have someone rewrite the encryption to do this all the time. Does Apple get dragged into this consistently on all kinds of cases?
Right.
So I get it. They've got to raise the flag and fight it.
Absolutely.
I think they'll work something out.
I think Donald Trump is completely wrong on this ridiculous idea to boycott Apple. And I guess he sent a couple tweets on that first with his iPhone, actually, about boycotting Apple. There's Donald Trump, you know. But he did apparently then switch to a Samsung phone after that, when it was pointed out to him that he might be a little bit off on that. But yeah, I think we both know how this is going to work out. All right, so that's about all the time we have for this week's episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And if you have any thoughts, comments, or criticisms, or any questions for our Ask the Politics Guys podcast, which comes out every Wednesday, we would love to hear from you. Our email is politicsguys@gmail.com. That's politicsguys, one word, @gmail.com. Our Facebook page, where Jay and I post and comment on news articles throughout the week, and where you can comment too, is facebook.com/politicsguyspage. And in the last few weeks, we've actually had some really great comments, some listeners that are very fired up over things, and we definitely love to see that.
Keep it coming.
Keep it coming, absolutely. And if you're listening to us on iTunes or Stitcher, we would really appreciate it if you could take just a minute to rate the show and write a quick review. The Politics Guys will be back next Sunday. We hope you'll join us.